Hey everybody, welcome to this month's live call as part of the Inner Circle. I am joined today by a new friend of mine who I had the pleasure of sitting down for lunch, and then I don't know, maybe it was like a 2.5, 3 hour lunch. They probably are ready for us to leave. But her name is Vinita Prachi Mudarka, and she is an incredible human being. Vinita is an Ayurvedic doctor level practitioner, Waldorf educator, mystic, and author who helps people transform everyday habits into powerful medicine. She blends classical Ayurveda, developmental wisdom, and spiritual insight into down-to-earth practices that improve digestion, sleep, hormonal balance, and energy. How you doing, Vinita?
I am so happy to be here and see you on the other side.
I know, right? Yeah, you're happy to be where you are, is what you were just saying. You're happy not to be in cold Colorado right now.
I'm happy not to be in cold Colorado as someone with my constitution. It gets me pretty imbalanced, but I'm balanced where I am. And I'm also excited to have this conversation because we went to so many different places when we talked last.
Oh my gosh, we went everywhere, and we had to go our separate ways. As even as it was getting even more interesting, we started talking about anthroposophy and early Rudolf Steiner work, and places that I didn't even know we were going to go. So I don't know if we'll get to it all on this call. I mean, this might be the beginning of a little series we do. So let me just see here. I want to make sure that everybody, if you want to ask us questions again, for those who just got here, use the chat thread, and then I will try to field anything that comes down the river as we have our conversation. The theme for today's call is, I don't even know. I don't know the exact pronunciation of it, but maybe you tell me. But Dinacharya, is that right, or is that completely about butchering
I
the?
think your Sanskrit is better than you give credit for, Nick. That
Yes.
was good.
You
That
know, there's a little bit of Spanish. I mean, I'm rolling a little bit of my Spanish vibe into there,
was
and it seems to be fooling
It's from the same roots, the
you.
Indo-European languages.
True. So what is it? What is this Dinacharya?
So Dinacharya, we could say, is lifestyle medicine. It's working with circadian rhythms, the five elements to optimize your life and your energy and your well-being over a long period of time. These are like foundational basics around what is the time that you wake up? Are you connecting with the sun? Are you connecting with the moon? What time are you eating to optimize metabolism, Agni, digestion, fulfillment of nutrients? And are you designing a life that is optimal to your body, mind, and purpose? So that's really the science of Dinacharya, I would say.
Interesting. Okay. This is really, I mean, I know a lot of us, including myself right now, are going off the deep end in terms of meditation, especially in today's crazy world. It seems like you can't just kind of like float along without having a practice, without starting to experience crazy anxiety and having a hard time sleeping and things like that. So I think that is turning a lot of folks into these like next evolution of their spiritual warriorhood, like learning how to take care of their spiritual energy hygiene. And I feel like that's where Ayurveda, at least for me, has become like, I didn't realize that I was practicing already some of the core tenets of Ayurveda, just from working outward from meditation and what meditation is showing me to do with my life. But it sounds kind of like Dinacharya is kind of like sort of working with other elements besides, I guess, the other elements of your life besides being on the mat meditating, like how to bring that into your daily life. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it's all about routine. Like Dina means day and Acharya means the way you circle around it. So it's about what are your routines in the morning, in the evening, what are your rituals that help you feel present and clear? So that can be at work, That can be with your family or with your children. That can be, with nature. It's all about optimizing presence, I would say. And when we're meditating, that's the practice of that. That's like becoming super present with oneself, one's mind, with one's body, and one's purpose. And I think that deepening of the frequency and presence, it can be carried out throughout the day if we know how to understand our rhythms and schedule our day so that instead of being anxious or having bad energy hygiene, like where people are kind of running with their heads cut off, you can really be loving, open, present, and have skillful, intuitive guidance throughout your day and night.
Is this something that is like standard? Like, is it standard in India? Like, is this something that most people who are, on the spirit path in whatever way are doing? Is this something that's kind of like a, or is it something that is a part of a certain tradition?
So I would say, one, it's like part of agricultural traditions and agricultural societies overall. If you're a farmer, you're waking up at a certain time with the sun or before the sun to be able to work in the field and get certain things done. And then you have a meal and then go back out. So people who are less connected with technology, with lights, with working on the computer and living in nature, they're in a more holistic rhythm already, just because they're having to follow the rhythm of the sun and the moon. I would say within India, Dinacharya is really followed with relationship to Vedic festivals and Hindu festivals. I would say the majority of the continent is not following it right now because I definitely have family members who are eating their dinners around 10 p.m. at night, which I do not recommend. I recommend going to sleep by then.
When you and I were hanging out, like, what was it, 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago? We were talking about how there's certain people, a lot of whom are probably also on this call, who are more sensitive and more sensitive to energies and have, I guess, other abilities and maybe wouldn't necessarily fit in with the norm of what Western society is sort of defining itself as these days. And it feels like the Dinacharya, like, practices are almost like a must for people who are more sensitive and who are, on that like that spirit path that requires more purity on a regular basis. Like you're saying that most people in India are not on this, and I'd say that most people in the Western world are not on this, type of protocol. And I feel like maybe it's feeding into like the numbness and like the dullness of people's sensory perceptions.
I would agree with that. When you were asking about what traditions is this practiced in? So I would say in many different ashrams within India, Dinacharya is followed. There's usually a fairly strict schedule around waking and sleeping. And it's because it helps align ourselves with the cosmic order. And I would say people who are more sensitive, they might be open to supernatural perceptions, cosmic influences, whether we're talking about the sun, the moon, the stars, the planets. And we know that something is happening, even if we can't always verbalize it. People who are studying astrology can verbalize exactly what's happening in terms of the psychological impact. But for those of us who might not be studying it as in depth, there can be the feeling that there's a movement being created or an inward pull that's being there. And if we're in a more, I would say, like capitalist, go, go, go Western model that's outside of rhythms, we might push beyond what our innate intelligence and awareness is trying to guide us towards.
Yeah, 100%. So that's like in perfect, like syncs up with us. I was in a tea ceremony yesterday with a couple friends, my friend Nishi, and my friend Nicole. They're both incredible human beings in their own way. They're both mystics, but we were talking about this idea of the illusion of this reality taking hold on you, and sort of how to know what's the illusion and what's real, and working backwards from sort of like this, the state of like samadhi, into and how to bring that samadhi state into your walking life, and how hard it is to do that, because this reality that we live in, this Western, especially this Western construct that we live in, is so sticky that you could come back from a 90 days in the ashram and then be and be in fully balanced and harmonized with like your highest self, and then within like a month of being back living in your normal life, like these illusions, I guess, or whatever we want to call them, the reality, the constructs we have around this existence in society at large, they're sticky, and they kind of pull at you, and they kind of after a while they start taking hold, and a lot of times you forget like the true essence of who you are. And so I feel like this practice, this hygienical protocol, is kind of a way for you to continue to remember who you are even through all of that.
I would agree, and I know Nishi because he used to live here in Kauai.
Do you?
I do. I
Oh my
do.
gosh, you know Nishi and Nicole? Oh my
I
God, this world. How did you know? I didn't even tell you his last name. You just knew who Nishi, because Nishi and Nicole.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. Okay. Wow.
And I only know one Nishi, so
Yeah.
I figured within the Boulder context, it's that one, you
It
know.
is. He's awesome.
So, you know, something my teacher says, she said, if you're in a perfume factory, when you're gonna walk out, you're gonna be perfumed. And if you're in a charcoal factory, when you walk out, you're gonna have soot. And the way that I see going to an ashram or being in practice, it's like being in a perfume factory. You're like revitalizing and getting connection with the essence of life and what is bringing fragrance and joy to your being. And when you're, you know, walking around working in the more materialistically minded world, which forgets that we are spirit, or I would say we have at least five spiritual bodies, if not more, depending on which system you're going to. We keep thinking that we're the mind, or we are our accomplishments, or we are certain forms or names that we give ourselves, and we get really tied into ego consciousness. And so that's why I think it's super important to have that morning practice, to have that evening practice, and then also like take time for retreat. And I think the evening time, you know, you brought up Anthroposophy, Nick. That's the time where, if we consciously go to sleep, you know, I'm saying off our devices in a space of ritual, journaling, prayer, setting up our dream space, that's when we re-enter the spiritual world and get reinvigorated with the knowledge of who we are because we're not within our sensory consciousness.
Totally. Before I ask you 1,000 questions, I'm just going over to the chat thread here. I wanted to ask you a few questions that are coming in. Michael asked a great question, and I just jumped right in. You guys, I'm sorry about this. So Vanita and I have already hung out, so I totally know who she is. You guys don't even know who she is. And Michael's like, interesting things in your bio. I haven't really heard about how you arrived in your current role. And I know that you have an incredible story. I don't even know where you want to start, but how did you come to be where you are right now?
Okay, I'm going to try to keep it short. I would say, at least in terms of Ayurveda, my father is a double kidney transplant patient with diabetes. And when my grandmother, his mother, was going through a breast cancer journey, he went, to meet the Dalai Lama's physician, and the Dalai Lama's physician told him that within his pulse, like, hey, you have kidney stuff going on, you should take care of it. He told me he was too busy, building his business, building the family, taking care of the family, and didn't listen to that warning. He then, had to, he got to a stage of disease where we moved back to India. He was getting Ayurvedic treatment. We came back to the United States. We had a yogi living in our basement doing havans, fire ceremonies, every day for at least a few months. And then our family guru, who, I mean, I want to say she's a badass. Like she was. She's from Ahmedabad, and she was a woman who used to protect women from domestic violence. And, regardless of how you consider guns, like she was carrying a gun to protect women from domestic violence and one of the few women in India to do so. And her teacher eventually told her, "Your job is not to be an activist. It's to be a healer." And he took her under his tutelage and began to teach her. So she came to the United States, and within my elementary school in Indiana, in a town of 30,000 with very few Indians, she was teaching Ayurveda and yoga. So this is like my first introduction into Ayurveda and its potential. And I really think something happened at that time that I wasn't fully aware of until later. Then I went to college. I was at my first year at Northwestern, and I'd already gone into a meditation practice and was like really questioning our space in the universe. And I wanted to quit school. I was like, I'm done. I want to go to an ashram in India. I found a great place in Pune. And my parents said, hey, Ma, our family guru is in New Jersey. Like, stop by there before you go to India and get her permission. And she said at that time, she said, your job is not to go to an ashram right now. You need to fulfill your responsibilities. And I think you should study medicine. And I was really into policy and gender studies and race studies. And I was like, I don't buy into the allopathic complex. I really don't want to study medicine because all my friends who are pre-med are like basically not following Dinacharya. They're like super stressed out, staying up until like 5 in the morning studying macrobiology. And I just don't want to do that. And it was through, I had PTSD in college, and then I restarted studying yoga through a local teacher and got into some of the foundations of Ayurveda. And I would say it's through my own healing journey that yoga and Ayurveda came back to me. And instead of going into more of the policy world, I became a massage therapist and a yoga teacher, moved to India, started working in villages, learned how to talk to plants and animals, and was taken under the guidance of several Ayurvedic, naturopathic, and homeopathic doctors who began to teach me Ayurvedic principles and energy healing principles. And then I was going to become a full-time Waldorf teacher and got into that, but then had a major car accident that gave me a brain injury. And as someone who was super intellectual, it was like the most painful thing for my ego, like ever. My entire sense of self was totally shattered. And Ayurveda was one of the main modalities that helped me come back to a sense of purpose and wellness.
Could you tell us about your time with Amma?
Yes. And I love that this is a place where I can go into the mysticism of it. So I'd done Vipassana in Goenka's tradition, like many, many different sits, at least 5 or 6. And I was going through this place where there was like a deep somatic opening that was happening. And at the same time, my extrasensory perception was opening and I was able to see spirits and other things. But it wasn't easy. It wasn't like, ooh, my extrasensory perception was opening. It was like, there is no place for this kind of consciousness and I'm scared. And I was like, if enlightenment exists, if I'm supposed to continue on this meditation path, I need a guide. Like I'm gonna quit meditating unless there's someone who can really answer the questions that I have. And I was in like deep prayer mode around that, saying like, if I'm on this path towards enlightenment, show me someone who's really enlightened to that capacity. And several friends told me about Amma at a gift economy farm that I used to work on in San Francisco, and then some of my sisters in Berkeley, and they took me to see Amma, and I fell asleep. Like I was 5 feet in front of her. The Shakti was so strong, I fell asleep. And then I got to have the hug, and I thought I was enlightened. Like I was so in love with everyone. My heart was so open. I could see the essence of myself. And it was extraordinary. I was like, yes, enlightenment does exist, and this is it. And you know, it lasted a few days.
Amazing. You guys, if you don't know, so Amma the hugging saint, I'm sure that most of you have heard of her, but she's like, wow. I probably was at one of the events that you were at, I don't know what they were called, but basically you go to these gatherings where Amma is, and she's like, there's like this line zigzagging all over the place to kind of like walk up to Amma and get Amma's hug, because there's a transmission that happens, and everybody's like, I didn't think there was going to be anything that happened, but it totally there's a transmission that happens, and it's crazy. So yes, sorry, go on, I cut you off.
Well, I'm so glad you say that because some people don't have experiences and some people do. And I mean, I was like totally in love, like went to as many more of those long nights as I could. And luckily in the Bay Area, she comes back twice. So I met her in the summer. And then around Thanksgiving, I didn't have a car. Like, there were so many things going on that made it almost impossible to see her. And I remember that there was a scent of roses that came through. Like, it's my entire community home, at least for me, was filled with the smell of roses. And I was like, whoa, what's happening? And I was like, oh, Amma's in town. She's calling me. And I knew that that was like a message that she's calling me. And there was an event to get into her meditation that started at 10. There were like logistical complications on how to get there. And one of my landmates shows up and says, hey, do you need anything? And I said, well, you know, I'd really like to go to this event. And they said, well, let's see if my motorcycle's working. And we checked the time, and with the motorcycle, I got there at like 9:55 or 10 o'clock. So miracles happen, and then she's from a fishing village, so I would say she was like a fisherwoman who pulled me in, and I quit my life in the Bay Area, and within 2 months was packed and ready to go to India.
What are like are there some like key things that you learned from her that you remember that are like, I don't know, top of mind? I know you must, I mean, it's hard to ask her even to answer that kind of a question, but like, are there some things that she taught you that are the ultimate teachings?
Yeah, I would say one of them is she says the heart is like a needle that sews together, and the intellect are like scissors that cut. So what I have taken that to mean is to use the intellect to cut through illusions and what's real and what's unreal, you know, to really build discernment. And be with the heart to come into unity consciousness, to be connected with one another, with oneself, and with one's community. And that's also within her Mahavakya, which we would say are two seed syllables that encompass everything. And what Amma uses is Ma and Om. And Ma is the divine mother that says, and this, and this, and this. I am this, and this, and this. So, I'm the yogi and I'm the person living in Boulder who's working full time, or like I am all of it. And Nathi, Nathi, Nathi is the Om aspect or the Shiva aspect or the Divine Father, which is saying, I'm none of these things, I'm universal consciousness. So I feel like life is this dance between I'm everything and united with everything, and then the remembrance that I'm also none of that. And it's like a total Advaita aspect of being both simultaneously.
So
And
cool.
there's a
Yeah,
lot more I could share.
it's got like that, like non-dualistic. It's like you're everything, the everything and the nothing, or the void is not empty. It's like there's like it's it has a lot of that non-dual perspective to it, I guess.
Absolutely.
Michael's asking, what points of difference in understandings and practice would you say Ayurveda and Dinacharya practices have compared to those of evolved Western medicine, functional medicine, environmental medicine, and lifestyle medicine?
I would say actually lifestyle and functional medicine are often coming back towards the same Dinacharya practices. A lot of these practices are within our texts that are anywhere from 3 to 7,000 years old. So there are specific things that practitioners of Ayurveda will reference. But I would say that modern science is really just giving, credence to what's within Ayurveda in the first place. I think where I would say classical Ayurveda is different from modern functional or lifestyle medicine is that there's more of a connection to nature and the five elements. So it's not about just being within an office system and healing oneself through IVs or your regular routines. It's also about like forest bathing, connecting to trees, like waking up with the sun, gazing at the moon. Those are important aspects of being within the circadian life and also with connecting to subtle energies. I would say, in terms of metabolism and digestion, I think we're on a very similar page of you have your largest meal around lunchtime, maybe a slightly smaller meal in the morning, and then your smallest meal at night. I would say Ayurveda is different in terms of one size doesn't fit everyone. We really work with prakriti or doshas, saying that everyone has a unique constitution. So the same kind of routine doesn't work for every body. So if someone has more of a vata, which is wind and space constitution, they're going to need more systems for their nervous system. And they're probably going to wake up a little bit later and sleep a little bit earlier than, say, someone who's kapha, primarily earth with a little bit of water, because that person needs to wake up earlier for their optimal health. And so there's this fine tuning of working with each specific individual according to where they are in their stage of life and with their unique constitution to find, okay, here's a general rhythm. And then how do we shift that a little bit so that it's perfect for your constitution? So, say for my constitution, I need to have 3 meals a day and maybe even 2 snacks. But other constitutions, like the Kapha constitution, intermittent fasting is kind of the best way to go. And it depends on if you have a disease, if you don't have a disease, if you're super healthy, and then working accordingly with that. Did I miss anything? Or can I expect, is there any way I can expand on
I have thousands of questions as always, so don't worry, don't
that?
worry. I don't think you missed anything. How does somebody figure out what their dosha is?
So I think finding one's own constitution, one's own dosha, it is best done with a practitioner. The way that I assess is I read people's pulses in person and remotely, and then I'll check what their dosha is, and I'll also ask them a bunch of questions. So there's specific questionnaires that you can answer, and it's your body constitution, what you physically look like. If we're looking at a median, are you more on the thinner side or the larger side or right in the middle? Do you tend to have a lot more dryness or wetness, like on your skin? Teeth are an important element, like looking at the shape of somebody's teeth or the strength of someone's teeth, like facial features, body structure. So there's really, it's mostly constitutional. What I find when people are doing self-questionnaires is they're oftentimes assessing their imbalance and not their baseline constitution. And a really good astrologer can look at your birth chart and tell you your constitution too.
What? So yeah, I've been hearing a lot. Well, Nishi, our mutual friend Nishi's an astrologer. He and I honestly, this is going to come to a shock to the people on the call right now, but I just don't know much about astrology. And honestly, like, it's hilarious because of all of the things that I do believe in: astral travel, shamanism, all kinds of crazy ceremonial things, spiritual things that I've encountered along the way. Like, I just have no understanding, or really have, as of yet, any faith in astrology as being something that I should be paying close attention to. So I would love to talk. I would love it to get your take on Vedic astrology, and how it can be used for healing purposes.
Yeah, so when I look up at a Vedic birth chart, which is more sidereal, so it's different than Western astrology, I'm looking to see if a planet is strong or if it's weak, or if a certain house is weak or strong, because each of the 12 houses corresponds with a specific body part or system. So the first house has to do with the physical body and primarily with the head. When we're looking at the sixth house, we're looking at daily routine and oftentimes digestion and the stomach. The eighth house has to do with reproduction, the reproductive organs. There's a certain amount that I do myself, and if a case is super complex, I'll call one of my friends who's a strong Ayurvedic, Vedic astrologer, and I'll say, hey, this is a really complex case. What planets might be weak that I could be missing, or what is happening in terms of a dasha, so in terms of transits that I should look out for. So something that's unique about Vedic astrology is that there's different time periods that people go through, planetary cycles. So you could be going through a South Node or Ketu cycle, a Venus cycle, a Mars cycle. And say if your Mars is super strong, then you can use specific colors, gems, herbs to keep that strength and also like help with the willpower and the action. But say someone has a weak Venus. I'll give a short example. I'm not going to go too in depth, but I have a friend in her eighth house. She had a debilitated Jupiter, and Jupiter has to do with expansion. And she had cancer. And so there was something within the intelligence of the expansion of the cells that was off, and that was showing up in her reproductive system. And she had, I think it was uterine cancer. So there's these correlations that can be made around health issues that someone could have at a specific time period in their life. and which aspects of their health it can show up in. So I've had it where my astrologer has told me, like, hey, you really need to look after your gums and teeth because there's a specific transit you're going through. And did I have to look after my gums and teeth at that time? Yes, I did. I needed to pay extra attention to that.
It's so interesting. Like, it's so interesting that astrology, it sort of it pervades like almost every tradition. I mean, as much as I don't know, people who are on the call, let us know how you feel. But like for me, I grew up in Connecticut, and like as much as I feel like I've become a pretty worldly, well-seasoned person, like there's still parts of Connecticut that definitely have taken hold, have colonized my mind. And I think that this distrust of astrology is just one the next it's like the next piece that needs to fall. It's like the next part of me that needs to dissolve and like open. Because when you look at every tradition, I mean every ancient tradition has astrology, deep astrological roots. And I remember reading, even certain books by I forgot what the book was called. Early on in my life, I read a book called I think it was Think and Grow Rich. It was like this early book by Napoleon Hill in the early 1900s. He interviewed all the robber barons and a lot of the big kings of industry from back then, like Henry Ford and Rockefeller and JP Morgan. And like they all JP Morgan, there's a whole part of it where a lot of these people with who are deeply connected into some of the other mystery traditions too, Freemasonry and stuff, they all believed and relied heavily on astrology as well. So it's just this really interesting thing that it seems to have been kind of downplayed and sort of marginalized and kind of and painted in a certain way by some more of like the rational, patriarchal Western mindset. And it feels like it's something that is just ripe to be a better understood, because clearly, I mean, it's practiced and utilized by the rest of the world, so there has to be something to it. It's just fascinating the idea that these larger bodies in these larger bodies in space would have such an impact on how we function. But I guess to the extent that we are not separate from the cosmos, and we are just a part of it all, then how would these the motion of these bodies in space not have an effect on our well-being, you know?
And I would say that these bodies affect our astral body, primarily, the body of the stars, astral. And from my studies, each of the planets corresponds with a specific chakra and aspect of the endocrine system. So it's
Okay.
almost like when there's transits happening or planets are moving, then one's own past karma or aspects of the subtle body will get activated at that time. And then within yoga, there are practices that, even if we could say certain seeds of consciousness or unconsciousness are being brought forth, you can use those practices so that they don't manifest in the physical body. So we're moving from the most subtle realm to the grossest physical realm. And so
Sorry, go on, please.
if we have the highest attunement with the mind, like yogis often won't use astrology. They're beyond the five elements and they have control over their subtle bodies. But for those of us who don't have full control over their subtle body, which includes me, the Ayurvedic and astrological practices are helpful because we can, if there's a push going this way, we can have a counter force through different actions to that force, before, we're just able to transcend.
I love that idea. I've never heard it put that way, that it's not necessarily our physical bodies. Because I think of like the moon affecting the tide, affecting the ocean as being the clearest example of how larger bodies in space can affect physical things here on Earth, right? So if that happens to if water can get pulled to that degree then to smaller, more subtle degrees, because we're made of whatever percent water, and and other compounds, like to that extent, then obviously there's something be pulling on us too, and that could create all kinds of different effects. So, but you're saying the astrological body is what's affected most by these. It's just a really cool other way of looking at it. And you even mentioned the endocrine system, which I had never heard of. I never heard either that the endocrine system, specifically had a lot of reliance or was impacted by these larger bodies in space, which is really, really interesting. I just wonder, is there like a book that you would recommend that talks about this stuff? Is that what medical astrology is? I'm trying. Malene and I have been talking about medical astrology because we have another upcoming thing that deals with that, and I really don't know much about it. But
That would be in medical astrology. I don't have, I can ask a friend about what would be a good intro book to medical astrology. I like to learn through talking to people, similar to you. So it's mostly for me been through specific teachers and friends who've taught me this information, or even reading, like autobiography of a yogi and things that Yogananda Paramahamsa is saying on how the planets are affecting one's consciousness.
It's so cool. Awesome. I'm just going to pull a question here from the chat thread. Gloria asked, how would Ayurveda support or understand those who are neurodiverse or have, yeah, neuro, I guess let's keep it there, who are neurodiverse?
I'm going to pull from not just Ayurveda, I'm going to pull from Access Consciousness and Anthroposophy in terms of neurodiversity, because that's the way that I think.
Would you mind defining anthroposophy? Because I think a lot of folks don't know what it is.
Yes, and I'll also define Access Consciousness too. So Anthroposophy was founded by, I want to say, an initiate, a yogi named Rudolf Steiner in the early 1900s. He'd studied theosophy with Madame Blavatsky and Leadbeater and had taken these teachings and then developed anthroposophical medicine, biodynamic farming, Waldorf education. And I think his work is some of the best in terms of understanding the subtle body. And then Access Consciousness is a body of energetic work that I practice that's more contemporary, within the last 20, 30 years, that looks as neurodiversity as X-Men, or having very specific capacities that are, maybe not as commonly expressed when we're looking at the majority of humanity. And, we talked a little bit about this during our lunch, Nick. So when I see neurodiversity, I see it as, okay, what are your gifts? Like, what are the gifts that are trying to be expressed? And then are there ways that those gifts have been impacted by trauma? Is there trauma that is affecting one's ability to incarnate of all the subtle bodies into the physical body consciously, with all those bodies integrated and energy and information flowing smoothly? And are there practices we can do with nutrition, lifestyle, herbs, or subtle therapies that can help the integration of the subtle bodies and the embodiment of one's gifts? So, and the strengthening of the nervous system, because oftentimes neurodiversity can have to do with having a really open psychic field and not necessarily having a nervous system that's strong enough to handle that. So it's about having energy management tools that can help you express those gifts. And I think mythology is a part of it too, right? Within an Ayurvedic or yogic tradition, maybe that neurodiversity is actually a siddhi or a gift that's on the sign of awakening. So a lot of my work with people has been being able to differentiate what are psychic openings and what are psychic imbalances, because there can be that fine line between hallucination that is caused by poisons or imbalances in the systems versus visions. And that has to do with, I would say, sparking cellular intelligence, like being able to awaken sattva or clarity and consciousness of mind and stability in that consciousness and being able to access those states through one's choice and through one's will.
I think that's like so one of the hardest parts about the neurodivergence piece. As a fellow neurodivergent, I call myself a mutant. I mean, might write a book called Mutants just to talk about the X-Men type vibe of us neurodivergent folks. Is that sometimes when you are having those visions or you're having those downloads where you're tapping into something that isn't you, it can be scary because you're not really. Sometimes it feels like. It's a fine line, like I think you said, between being sensitive and receiving information from some other source that's more that's too subtle for most of the world, the rest of the world to be able to tune into. There's a fine line between that and what might be defined as any number of pathologies, schizophrenia, for example, or something along those lines. So it's a fine line between those two things, and I'm not even sure if there even is a line. At some point, I feel like there's almost a need to reclassify a lot of the terminology that we have psychologically for how brains work, because it's sort of skewed towards this Western medical perspective as opposed to bringing into the conversation all of these different spiritual phenomena from different traditions. You know what I mean?
And I feel like this is a space where I can go there. I think many of us don't just have human DNA. I think we have,
So yeah, do it.
yeah, we,
You would
okay.
go
I was
without
like,
just.
as long as I have permission, like we have intergalactic DNA encoding, and people who have more of that, or even memories of living in civilizations outside the United, outside Earth, like there can be certain capacities that are being brought in, not actually as a way to generate change and as a way to generate more consciousness and awareness. So I would say within, like, I've struggled with this, where a friend of mine told me, he said, within a traditional African society, the gifts that you have would make your parents really proud, and you'd be like in a priestess role. But then within even the current, I would say, Indian model, my family has been super confused about what I've been doing and not fitting in, because there's multi-dimensional intelligence that's at place, but it's being a mystic in this contemporary society that doesn't give as much credence to specific roles that are connecting, without having to put it in like a very capitalist model, or like put your ego in a specific place. Like, we don't have the same kinds of initiations that are present within traditional societies.
Yes. I was just thinking about the gosh, what's the podcast that everyone, oh, the telepathy tapes. Have you listened to the telepathy tapes yet?
I haven't listened to them, but people have told me about some of the conversations that are happening.
It's pretty emotional. It's emotional, I guess, as someone, I think if you are neurodivergent, it's emotional to listen to it because it's about autism, but it's really speaks to a lot of things that you're saying. Like people on the call, people who are listening, probably I'm sure a handful of them have listened to the telepathy tapes. I haven't listened to the most recent season, but basically it's a journalist is going who discovers and through a long chain of events that there are autistic children who are nonverbal around the world that can communicate with each other, and they all meet in a certain location, and they also communicate with other entities. And she put they do all these tests to see if they're crazy, to see if there's some way that these kids are just so smart that they're fooling everybody. But It just spoiler alert, like there are crazy things that happen, you know, that are that are impossible, that can't be explained away in the series. And it's just a really emotional and amazing persona on so many levels. It's so inspiring. Like it's just anyway, but there is a lot of this otherworldly, other planetary stuff that these nonverbal kids are talking about, you know, with each other. They all meet in these places and they talk about things that they all agree upon. They have never met each other, but they use the same proper nouns to describe specific things. And so I think it kind of speaks to what you're talking about. Like there's a, you know, I love this idea. Gloria, you open up a Pandora's box because a lot of us are neurodivergent. And Malia and I've talked about creating a whole either workshop or a whole series that's all about neurodivergence, because I think it's something that most that we're starting to realize, you know, a lot more people are working with than we initially thought. I have one more question. I know we've only got 5 minutes left. Can I ask you one more question that someone asked up the pipeline here? Michael says, only if she feels comfortable to share, but after the traumatic brain injury, what was the recovery process like, and what aspects of Ayurveda or other systems were involved to get you to be doing all that you do now?
It has been, I would say, there's astrology involved, astrology, grace, a little bit of classical Western medicine, functional medicine, and Ayurveda. So when I was looking at my astrology chart, within a specific South Indian form of astrology, there's called the shadow of Saturn in the first house, which is there to kick your ego. That's there for me. So, you know, that means potential head injury or injury to the physical body to help initiate you into a higher level of consciousness. And that's been super helpful. And I've been in this phase called Ketu or South Node, which is really about the physical body and a lot of clearing past karma. So a lot of the challenges that I've gone through psychologically and physically, I've been able to at least have the stories of astrology as a really supportive narrative. I would say I did Panchakarma, where I went to Vaidyagrama in India, which is an Ayurvedic center, to do Panchakarma, where I drank ghee for about a week. Pretty intense to open up the channels and clear the channels and move
Ghee, like butter.
butter. Yeah, like a
Whoa.
glass of warm, medicated, bitter butter.
Whoa. Whoa.
And as I was doing that, I could feel unresolved emotions and memories move through my body. And the idea is that these things that are stuck, whether called ama, metabolic things, ooh. That was loud. Metabolic toxins and emotional toxins move into the digestive tract to be moved out. A head injury increases vata, or the air and wind element in the body. So, getting super oiled up and then having enemas or specific practices that move out that vata is really important because the body can't really heal until that extra vata is out. So, in terms of multiple markers, including eye vision, like vision functioning, because my vision capacity shifted quite greatly. There was occipital damage, so different parts of my brain and eyes and weren't cooperating. After doing Panchakarma, including getting ghee through my eyes, all the markers improved, and my ability to do vision therapy, neurovision therapy, was much better because a physiological aspect was taken care of. Even though I know that Ayurveda has heavy metal detoxification, I chose to go a functional medical route and go through IVs, which does bypass Agni, but it's because I've been dealing with this for almost 8 years, and I knew this would be a faster process, and I really trusted the functional MD that I was working with. I also met an extremely gifted healer on Kauai who used to work with MMA fighters and Bruce Lee's teacher and had worked with head injuries like globally, San Diego, Colorado, here. And she was able to guide me through a step-by-step plan and do really intensive manipulation to get my body back in shape. So I think oftentimes it's about finding a team. It's not necessarily about one practitioner. It's about finding a team of practitioners that you trust, who you feel like have a resonance with you. And ideally, they have some of the X-Men qualities. They have some of the neurodivergence that helps them see just beyond the physical and the medical to intuitively, like, what is your body asking for in the present moment? And like, I work with guides to come up with the spiritual sequence for people that I work with. So I think having a team, people who are willing to collaborate, who aren't stuck in their own silo, and then usually having a point person or like a chairperson for your healing committee is really helpful. Like, okay, this person might be saying this, but I can always go back to this person to ask their advice or help move the treatment plan in a specific direction. With Ayurveda, I would say oil has been the biggest help. Body self-massage, nasya, medicated oil that goes up the nose, dietary changes to decrease vata, like everything had to be soothing, 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 and help regulate the nervous system as much as possible.
I feel like we're going to start like our own little X-Men neurodivergent members only club pretty soon, but I guess that's for another call. Terry said my grandson is autistic. Sat quietly and listened to him communicate with other realm. To me, it is clear. Thank you for mentioning the telepathy tapes. Totally. Yeah, you guys, please share anything cool like that. Please share it with us, because I'd love, I'm always down to dive into anything weird, off fringe, that's gonna give us a new perspective on the world and what's going on. Well, thank you for hanging out with us. I would love to have you back at some point, Benita. That was a lot of fun. I think that we could totally dive. I want to dive into anthroposophy so bad. I want to dive into all of the more of the occult, I guess, the mystery realms that get a really bad name by the Western world, but that actually have a lot of really incredible detail about other realities. The thing about Think about Steiner's work. I think we talked about this over lunch, was that like some of his books like paint, they describe these other planes of existence that I've been to in astral travel or out of body experiences or through visions, that I've never heard anybody give such concrete language to, and just describing them so viscerally, where it validated these places that I had been to that I had thought, I don't know, that I couldn't make any sense of, because I couldn't communicate with anybody else about, because I just didn't think anyone else had ever been there before. So I think that a lot of these other realms and these other planes of existence need to be openly discussed, so that we can solidify them and start giving language to them,
And I would say mystery schools and different esoteric traditions, they do share information about these different realms of existence. I would say Vajrayana Buddhism, Hinduism, Anthroposophy, Theosophy, those are ones that I've studied that definitely are speaking about that. And then within Christianity or Catholicism, there's definitely the realm of the saints and the saints interacting with miraculous healing too. So I think I love opening up these dialogues more so we know that it's normal and that we can access these. I think I'm still on the cautious side where sometimes accessing these realms, it's really important to have training so that you don't get lost in these realms or get deceived, and that there's enough of spiritual intelligence that is there within oneself, within one spiritual community, and with the teachers you're working with, so that with those openings, there's also a stabilization and an integration of that consciousness. And again, like being clear around what realms are being accessed, because sometimes people will be accessing realms and there will be entities that get caught into people's subtle fields, or there's tricksters and mischievous beings. So I think definitely having a high level of discernment, intelligence, path of practice, trusted guides is important too.
Yeah, I would imagine that part of that, whatever we're envisioning, is protection. Like knowing what protection looks like, whether it's actual like protection that you're like putting up, or whether it's things not to do to protect yourself. So just like you said, try being careful where you go, where you don't go, what you do, what you don't do. Like there's a whole culture of people. I live in Boulder. So like there's a whole culture of people that are like going to shamans and psychics and all the time. Like I have friends, friends of my wife's mostly, like who are like always kind of like excited to report the most recent, reading they just done. And they're like, well, I'm gonna re get, have them do a reading for you. And I'm like, no, don't have them do. No, I don't want any reading for me. Like, and it seems like it's sort of part of a. For me, it's like part of like I don't think there's any one-way communication. There's no such thing, in my opinion, as a one-way communication to access realms you can't access without giving. There's no just, oh, I got that, and that was all I, that, and it was just this one thing. I got the one thing I wanted, and that's it. Like there's always give and take. There's always reciprocity, at least in my opinion. I guess it's a kind of a karmic law, right? There is no just one thing that happens in a vacuum. Like there is an exchange. So
Oh my gosh,
I
this
want to
topic
know
is
what
so
the
exciting.
exchange is before I start getting involved in every. Probably get off, but yeah, I do feel that way though. Do you feel that way?
I do. You know, within Anthroposophy, Rudolf Steiner talks about how the angelic realms, the higher realms, they get nourished by our love, our reverence, devotion, and our desire to be of service. So what I think is that within the subtle realms, there's multiple types of beings, and our states of consciousness and our emotions can help nourish different types of beings. So it's our choice what kinds of beings we're choosing to nourish and be in reciprocity with. And we spoke about this a little bit when both of us met. I use a process called coning from Michelle Smallwright that helps connect with a spiritual hierarchy that's really looking for to support the evolution, awareness, and universal brotherhood, sisterhood of humanity, as in reciprocity with the earth, the elementals, and the devas, who are, you know, lords of creating form. So I think that there is a gift of moving towards consciousness and moving towards love, towards care, towards kindness, towards gratitude. And I know that there's spiritual beings out there who desire to support this, and we can ask support from the spiritual world if we would like, for the healing of ourselves, our relationships, and the collective and the earth.
Yeah. Aho. I think that we should probably call it for right now, and then maybe plan on doing this again sometime if you're up for
I am. This is just like a
it.
really fun hour-long conversation with a friend. Absolutely.
Know. That's the idea, is for us to hang out, all of us to hang out and just have really fun, enlightening conversations and support each other. And getting into the esoteric is always kind of where we go, because it's kind of where my mind always is. So, yeah, thanks for hanging out. Yeah, at some point I would love this. I would love to get the, and anybody on the call who has it, share it with us offline and we'll share it with the group. But I'd love to get a good medical astrology resource, because I would love, just personally would love to dive into that. It's definitely prominent and kind of something that, for me, it's something that I need to know more about. So maybe next time we'll show up with that resource for you guys next month. But thank you all for tuning in. Gloria said thank you. Thank you, Gloria. That was awesome. Thank you, Terry, for your awesome share, and Michael. And everybody whose name I'm not listing here. Thanks for tuning in as always. And yeah, Benita, thanks for hanging out. And I'm jealous that you get to go walk over to the beach if you want to right now.
Thank you, but you're always welcome to Kauai.
I know you live right down the street from my good friend Doug, Hawaii Pharmacy. Everyone knows each other. Nishi, Doug. It's crazy. Small world.
I think it's a small interconnected web. One of my friends calls it the humanoid. Something just fell. So I was like, okay, the humanoid multiverse or the humanoid universe, where people of a certain, frequency or understanding, like we all find each other.
Yeah, I mean, we're all curious, and we're all like tapping into the other realms. I mean, I think that, I don't know, I wouldn't have it any other way. Like yesterday when I was talking to Nishi and Nicole, I was like, these are the kinds of conversations I want to have. Because he's like, oh, okay, well, he's like, you probably have to go. I'm like, I don't want to go. Like, I could talk about this stuff forever, because it's the only thing that really seems interesting to me these days, is just the stuff that's hard to talk about because it doesn't have a lot of language attached to it yet. So, anyway, hopefully we can have another conversation like this and attach language to things that are hard to attach language to some other
Let's do it.
time.
Absolutely. And
Sweet.
Nick, thank you to you, Malene, and the Sacred Science team too. This has been really fun.
Yay. Cool. Well, more soon for sure. Everyone's saying thank you. I don't. Yes, everyone's saying thank you, Anna. Cool. Thank you, Paula. Awesome. All right. See you guys soon.